Hello, this is your Sun Sound of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, June 9th, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. The Philippines protests illegal Chinese raft in its maritime zone. Manila took appropriate diplomatic action with China's government over the 6-by-6-meter floating structure, about 390 square feet, equipped with what appears to be an antenna, in Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. China's foreign ministry dismissed the protest as hype. In recent years, China has built and militarized atolls and clashed with forces of the Philippines and other Southeast Asian countries. Beijing's sweeping claims to most of the South China Sea were ruled invalid by a 2016 tribunal under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. 4:03 p.m. ET staff. NASA announces the crew for Artemis 3. The next mission in NASA's effort to return humans to the moon by 2030 has a crew. Randy Bresnik will lead the mission. Italian space agency astronaut Lucia Parmitano is the mission's pilot. Mission specialists Andre Douglas and Frank Rubio round out the crew. With a launch scheduled for late 2027, Artemis 3 aims to test in low Earth orbit the Orion spacecraft's ability to dock with lunar landing craft. The crew is experienced, logging over 700 days in space between them. Mr. Bresnik has been an astronaut since 2004. Mr. Parmitano has completed 2 spacewalks, including one where his helmet began to fill with water. 1:34 p.m. ET staff. Progressive Democrat Nithya Raman advances in L.A. mayor's race. Ms. Raman, a city council member, surpassed Republican Spencer Pratt and will face incumbent Mayor Karen Bass in November. Mr. Pratt held second place in the race for days after the June 2nd election, but with 92% of votes counted, the Associated Press now projects that Ms. Raman, will beat him in the race for California governor. Former U.S. Health Secretary Javier Becerra passed the threshold to advance, but the race for second continues. 12:44 p.m. ET staff. OpenAI took a step toward becoming public. The company announced Monday it had filed for an initial public offering, a week after its competitor Anthropic did the same. The company says it hasn't yet decided on timing for when it will go public. Elon Musk's company Space Exploration Technologies Corp., SpaceX, is expected to hit the public market later this week. The public debut of these 3 defining technology companies puts them on track to raise massive amounts of money from investors and will allow for a clearer look at the company's financial data. 10:53 a.m. ET staff. Interstate conflicts at highest level since World War II. After decades when civil wars dominated global conflict, conflicts between states reached their highest level since 1946, according to the Peace Research Institute, Oslo, PRIO. 8 interstate conflicts were recorded worldwide. The report recorded 245,000 battle-related deaths in 2025, largely driven by Russia's war in Ukraine and violence in the Middle East. The return of interstate conflict at this scale is deeply worrying, said PRIO Research Director Siri As Rustad. 9:22 a.m. ET staff. Afghan protesters injured during demonstration against Taliban-imposed dress code for women. A crackdown by Afghan authorities on demonstrators in western Afghanistan has left at least 3 people injured, eyewitnesses say. The demonstrators were protesting the arrest and detention of more than a dozen women over dress code violations in the city of Herat. Eyewitnesses said armed police opened fire during the protest by around 150 people on Tuesday. Protests are rare in Afghanistan, which has been run by the Taliban since 2021 in the wake of the chaotic withdrawal of U.S.-led forces. It has since imposed rules governed by a strict interpretation of Islamic or Sharia law. 8:32 a.m. ET, Associated Press. 2 U.S. troops whose helicopter crashed near Iran are fine, says President Trump. The pilots were rescued after their Apache gunship went down yesterday, according to the New York Times, which broke the news. It's not clear whether the helicopter experienced mechanical failure or hostile fire near the Strait of Hormuz. No statement has yet been issued by U.S. Central Command, which last week warned that Iran has been launching one-way attack drones into the strait. A report about the crash will be released today, President Trump said. 7:17 a.m. ET Staff. Our first article today is from the Middle East. Syria flips the script. It's an island of calm in the stormy Middle East. By Taylor Luck, Special Correspondent. Damascus and Douma, Syria. While the rest of the Middle East is once again seized by uncertainty and eruptions of tit-for-tat rocket and drone strikes in the U.S.-Iran war, Syrians are experiencing a calm hope. Some are even calling it a revival. Water is plentiful. Electricity is around the clock. At night, the capital city and surrounding countryside are largely lit up, a far cry from the dark expanse that engulfed Greater Damascus a few months ago. Decades of dictatorship culminated in 15 years of war and turmoil in Syria, making the country a focal point of hardship in the Middle East. But with the region torn asunder by the U.S.-Iran war, a relatively peaceful Syria is now an outpost of progress and hope. The airport is busy once more. Ride-hailing apps summon Gen Z Syrian drivers at the wheel of brand-new luxury Chinese cars with refreshing air conditioning. Western goods flood the market. Young people talk of starting businesses, and new restaurants, gas stations, shopping malls, and private schools are opening up. The expressions of hope notwithstanding, Syria faces growing pains, including inflationary pressures, an unequal distribution of opportunity, and the legacy of decades of dictatorship that culminated in civil war. Yet after 15 years of conflict and chaos that made Syria an island of acute turmoil in a regional sea of relative calm, Syrians are now living a Middle East in reverse. For the first time, we feel more safe than other countries in the Middle East, says Isra, a government worker from the Damascus countryside. People from Dubai are coming here to escape war, while we are leaving our fears behind. We're not enjoying schadenfreude at there being war elsewhere in the region, says Dia Dakak, a trader and shop manager. But after years of suffering and being patient, it's now our turn in Syria to develop, progress, and step towards a better future. Most importantly, this time the war doesn't involve us. Ahmed is one of the many bullish Syrian investors. He has opened 3 businesses and a factory within the past 6 months. After decades of being terrorized and stymied by the criminal mafia regime, business is booming, he says. Despite such buoyancy, steep economic challenges remain. Job creation is sluggish, and large-scale reconstruction has yet to begin. Gulf countries have signed off on billions of dollars of investment, but help from Western governments has yet to arrive. The economy may be improving statistically, while ordinary citizens experience little immediate improvement in their daily lives, says Yasser al-Mashal, vice dean of the Faculty of Economics at Damascus University, describing it as a troubling paradox. Multiple officials and analysts note that Syrians have so far shown patience, but it is unclear how long it will last. The Syrian government has passed an investment law enacting sweeping incentives for foreign and local investors, strengthened its central bank, and is auditing its financial system to identify and fix compliance gaps. A new parliament, indirectly elected, is to convene this month. In the meantime, Syria faces an array of challenges that could limit its potential for growth. The U.S. Congress has yet to drop Syria's designation in 1979 as a state sponsor of terrorism during the autocratic rule of Hafez al-Assad. These sanctions, combined with a large gray cash run economy, are scaring away most Western investors and are leading banks and financial institutions to classify the country as high risk. While fluctuations in the Syrian lira's exchange rate prevent many young people from opening small businesses. At a high-level UN-sponsored conference last week, the Syrian Private Sector Dialogue, no Western investor or U.S. official attended, to the disappointment of Syrian businesses and industry leaders. Nevertheless, Syrians are looking positively towards the future. A year and a half ago, we would get 2 hours of electricity per day. Now we get 24 hours of electricity, says Mr. Dakak, the shop manager. We are connected to the world. As the next generation, we are optimistic about our future. Still, the optimism and economic growth create their own inflationary pressures. With the return of state-provided electricity, the government has raised electricity rates by as much as 6,000%. Electronics and other foreign products are flooding a market that was strictly controlled by the former regime, which banned most goods. Meat, poultry, and produce are getting more expensive, increasingly out of reach for middle-class families. Electronics and tech are more available, but the prices of basic goods are becoming out of reach, says Mustafa, an employee at the Damascus mobile phone and electronics shop. You can buy a smartphone, but it's getting harder to buy food. Vendors who used to sell vegetables by the 3-kilogram box, about 6.6 pounds, now say customers grab just a handful of potatoes or 2 onions. Syrians report struggling to find lamb, if they can even buy it. I can't afford the rent on my shop, and I haven't been able to pay the last 3 months of my electricity bills, said one produce vendor on Shalan Street, who withheld his name for privacy concerns. We thought interim Syrian President Ahmed al-Sharaa and this government would make good changes at first, but since they came in, all we have seen are prices rising. They fooled us. My heart wants to explode from the stress. A lot of the shock Syrians are experiencing are due to a country shifting from a state-managed economy led by a mafia-like dictatorship to a free and open market, economists say. Many citizens compare current prices to historically subsidized prices under the old regime, notes Mr. Mishal. This comparison creates the perception that prices have skyrocketed, when in reality much of the change reflects the removal of these artificial subsidies. But we are still positive, says Mustafa, the mobile phone vendor. We have options. We are connected to the globe, and we have the freedom to open up businesses without the fear of a regime that will take everything away from us. We are optimistic for development and progress in Syria. Isra, the government worker, says young Syrians are finally living a life stolen from us at childhood. We can work, cover our costs, go out with our friends, she says. We're living our full lives, and we see a chance for things to get better and better. This positivity extends from upper-middle-class business districts to more hard-scrabble working-class neighborhoods, such as Basra. There, Samira Ibo, a vegetable vendor in her 70s, smiles as she runs a street-side stand that is the lone source of income for her 18-person family. Rent is slamming people. Customers who used to buy a kilo of vegetables can barely afford a few pieces, she says. As she speaks, a customer passes on peas costing 90 cents per kilogram and opts instead for a single eggplant. But thank God we are happy, Ms. Ibo continues. No one is taking our young men off to be tortured or killed. We can look to the future with hope. The slow but steady improvements are also encouraging Syrian expatriates. Some 4 million Syrians, including hundreds of thousands of professionals, who were driven abroad by the war and live as far away as Canada and Australia. Raad Hussein, a 34-year-old dentist working in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, is one of many eyeing a return home, sensing the country is on track, but just not ready yet. He is anxious to return to Syria and open a dental clinic in Damascus, but is waiting for banking and digital infrastructure to improve. All I need is to cover my costs. I'm not looking to make large profits, he says. All of us want the chance to be able to work and contribute to developing our country. I was more scared living under the threats of rockets and drones in Riyadh than I was during the war in Syria, he says. When the rest of the region is living in uncertainty, we as Syrians are finally standing tall and proud. Wa'ala Bouhadani in Damascus supported reporting for this article. Our next article comes from The Explainer. The World Cup in 2026 is bigger than before. Is it better? By Mark Sappenfield, Senior Global Correspondent. When you are at the largest sporting event on Earth, what do you do next? Get bigger, naturally. World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has never been short on ambition. But this year's World Cup feels almost imperial. For the first time, three nations will host: the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And also, for the first time, 48 nations will compete, up from 32. This year's World Cup is the biggest ever, with more hosts, more teams, and more newcomers to the tournament. As a result, the competition may not look quite the same as it has in years past. But how will all this work, and what should fans expect? Here's a quick guide to the newest iteration of soccer's grandest extravaganza. A new format. The World Cup has used a 32-team format since 1998. Before that, there were 24 teams. And before that, until 1978, there were 16. FIFA President Gianni Infantino made expansion a big part of his candidacy for the job back in 2016. To no one's surprise, the new World Cup is expected to make more money. The 2022 edition had revenues of $7.5 billion. That is expected to climb to $8.9 billion this year. But there's also the simple fact that more nations want to be part of the sport's signature showcase. Every 4 years, countries from Germany to Argentina see the World Cup as a semi-holiday, with huge public watch parties in parks and pubs packed to standing room. A World Cup with 48 teams fundamentally changes who can reasonably expect to join. Four nations qualified for their first World Cup this cycle. And while Jordan and Uzbekistan might not seem too outlandish, there is also Cape Verde and Curacao. If Curacao, population 156,000, can make a World Cup, then the door is well and truly open for pretty much everyone. The teams will be divided into 12 groups of four for the opening round robins. The top two teams in each group, as well as the eight best third-place teams, advance to the knockout rounds. That means this year's knockout round will have as many teams as the previous World Cup had in total. It also means more games played over the course of the tournament, increasing from 64 to 104 all told. The finalists will now have to play 8 games, not 7, and the tournament will last 1 week longer, up to 39 days from 32 last time. Pity the poor soccer stars. Premier League champion Arsenal, for example, has finished its season on May 30th. If England plays Spain in the World Cup final, 7 of Arsenal's international players, 4 English, 3 Spanish, could end up with less than 2 weeks off before their preseason begins. The three hosts. Co-hosting is not new for the World Cup. Japan and South Korea jointly hosted the 2002 World Cup, and the European Championships, a World Cup-style event only for European nations, have done it 3 times. Netherlands-Belgium in 2000, Austria-Switzerland in 2008, and Poland-Ukraine in 2012. The 2020 Euros went so far as to have 11 host nations. This, it seems, is the future. We've already seen this trend with the Winter Olympics, which are increasingly splintering into many host areas as a way to defray the logistical and financial burden of holding such a massive event. With the World Cup expanding to 48 teams, single-nation hosts could become rare. The 2030 World Cup will again have 3 hosts, Spain, Morocco, and Portugal. Traditionally, the first game of the tournament involves the host nation and a formal opening ceremony. This year, there will be 3 opening ceremonies, starting June 11th in Mexico City, featuring Mexican versus South Africa, followed by games in Toronto with Canada versus Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Los Angeles with U.S. versus Paraguay on June 12th. This year, 11 of the 16 host cities are in the U.S., with 3 in Mexico and 2 in Canada. The final will be in New York. The new teams and the favorites. Though 4 teams will be new to the World Cup, another 6 will be making only their second World Cup appearance. Bosnia-Herzegovina, Haiti, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Iraq, Panama, and Qatar. Canada, making its 3rd appearance, lost all 6 games in its prior World Cup visits. The Democratic Republic of Congo, as Zaire, lost by a combined 0-14, including a 0-9 loss to now-defunct Yugoslavia in its 3 matches in 1974. This raises questions about the opening round. Will the presence of these comparative minnows, combined with 32 teams advancing to the knockout stages, mean a lack of drama? Has the new format made the first few weeks a soccer festival without much intrigue as to who will actually advance? Or could it be the perfect setup for a few fairy tale stories? No team from outside Europe or South America has ever won the World Cup. Only 3 nations outside those 2 continents have ever even made it to the semifinals: Morocco in 2022, South Korea in 2002, and gasp, the U.S. in the inaugural 1930 World Cup. No one is expecting a breakthrough this year. The favorites begin with Spain and France, with England, Brazil, Portugal, and Argentina not too far behind. The Blue Sharks of Cape Verde and the Blue Wave of Curacao would surely celebrate a single win, or maybe just a few goals. Just don't tell them their place wasn't earned. For the second World Cup in a row, four-time champion Italy failed to qualify and will be watching from home. And now from the Asia Pacific, we have an article, What Xi and Kim Gained from Their Summit in North Korea, by Ann Scott Tyson, staff writer. Chinese leader Xi Jinping hailed a new historic starting point in China's ties with North Korea during his rare state visit in Pyongyang this week, calling for stronger political and military exchanges between the Asian neighbors. Mr. Xi's two-date summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is part of a diplomatic charm offensive China is waging to boost influence over its socialist ally. Beijing has watched warily as Pyongyang has drawn closer to Moscow, providing thousands of North Korean troops to fight for Russia in Ukraine in return for Russian technology. China seeks, above all, to maintain stability on the Korean Peninsula, and it sees Mr. Putin's strategic pact with Mr. Kim, inked in 2024, as potentially disruptive, experts say. Russia has accepted North Korea's status as a nuclear weapons power. Chinese leader Xi Jinping, wary of growing ties between North Korea and Russia, turned on the charm in Pyongyang this week. For North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, the summit was about influence. For Mr. Xi, it was about stability. Russia is tangibly a more reckless actor in Northeast Asia, said Adam Farrar, non-resident senior associate with the Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies on CSIS podcast, reviewing the Xi-Kim summit. For his part, Mr. Kim seeks to bolster his international clout by giving a red carpet welcome to Mr. Xi, replete with rows of soldiers mounted on white horses. Crowds of people waving flowers and flags lined the street as Mr. Xi's motorcade arrived in Pyongyang's Kim Tu-sung Square, where buildings are draped with huge portraits of both leaders and a red banner proclaiming, "Long live the unbreakable friendship and unity between China and North Korea." Mr. Xi's visit is to small, isolated North Korea, his first international trip of the year, marked a diplomatic coup of sorts for Mr. Kim, who stressed it showed the great importance of the bilateral ties. China, the world's second-largest economy, is North Korea's most important ally and a critical trading partner. Mr. Xi said the two countries should enhance exchanges in diplomacy, law enforcement, military affairs, and other areas, according to state-run Xinhua News Agency. He also pledged to further boost trade, agriculture, and technology cooperation and called for increasing border crossings and flights to facilitate exchanges. North Korea depends on China for most of its imports, including food, fuel, and electronics, a lifeline that has grown more important as other countries have sanctioned Pyongyang over its nuclear weapons program. Bilateral trade has surged this year. Mr. Kim also seeks China's acceptance of North Korea's status as a nuclear power. Beijing has recently downplayed the issue of denuclearization, dropping the term from the official summary of the talks between Mr. Xi and Mr. Kim in the Chinese capital last September. Nevertheless, a Washington's account, Mr. Xi did discuss North Korea and denuclearization with U.S. President Donald Trump at their summit last month. The two leaders confirmed their shared goal to denuclearize the North Koreans, according to a White House fact sheet. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney, If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. And here's an article from the Christian Science Monitor magazine. Terrorism-related charges are a new tool to pursue illegal arms flow to Mexico. By Sarah Matsusik, staff writer, Sierra Vista, Arizona. With fewer than 50,000 people, Sierra Vista is a town of military discounts and very little shade. At a nearby U.S. Army fort, a white surveillance blimp sits in the Arizona sky like a mechanical cloud. A drive 50 miles south will get you to the border within Mexico. That's where an untold number of guns purchased in the United States have long shown up at deadly cartel crime scenes. Over the years, both the U.S. and Mexico have tried to stop what's sometimes called an iron river of guns. Last year, the Trump administration gave prosecutors a new tool. The U.S. government declared some of those cartels foreign terrorist organizations. The U.S. government has been unable to staunch the flow of guns purchased in America that were handed over to Mexican drug cartels. But since President Donald Trump declared cartels foreign terrorist organizations, prosecutors have a tool that some believe could make gun dealers more careful about who they sell to. In March, Lawrence Gray, an Arizona gun seller, was indicted on charges that include attempting to provide material support to a foreign terrorist organization. Mexico's Jalisco New Generation Cartel, and of conspiring with others to do so for that cartel and its rival, the Sinaloa Cartel. Neither Mr. Gray nor his lawyer responded to requests for comment. Gun trafficking experts say those terrorism-related charges against an American firearms dealer are likely a first. The accusations appear to respond to Mexico's demand for action on arms trafficking, marking potential progress in the United States' fraught but vital relationship with Mexico. There is a material weakness in the laws when it comes to firearms trafficking, says Bernard Zapor, a criminal justice professor at Arizona State University and former official in the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, known as ATF. Leveraging terrorism-related charges is a good enhancement that puts some teeth into this and potentially would cause some deterrence, he says. The U.S. has long accused Mexican cartels of pushing lethal drugs north. The Mexican government, meanwhile, has pleaded with American officials to stop the illicit flow of firearms south. In Mexico, the only legal gun seller is the military. Arizona alone has more than 12,000 licensed firearms dealers. Federal data from 2022 to 2023 shows Texas as the top source state for crime guns recovered in Mexico and traced to a purchaser, 7,825 of them, followed by Arizona, 3,969. Along the southern border, a route from Arizona to the Mexican state of Sonora trafficked the most. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo has urged the U.S. to respect her country's sovereignty. She appeared pleased that the White House's 2026 National Drug Control Strategy mentions the need to disrupt the flow of guns used by criminal groups to exert control and the need to curb U.S. demand for illicit drugs. Mr. Gray's business, Grips by Larry, was incorporated in Nevada over a decade ago, according to the state business records. While that name was tied to a federal firearms license, The related storefront in Sierra Vista was called The Other Guy's Guns, Ammo, and Accessories. Mr. Gray sold firearms, ammunition, optical gadgets, and gun grips made of mammoth tooth. The gun dealer modeled his rifles, pistols, and even a fire-breathing flamethrower for social media clips. "We have the largest selection of handguns in the country, I think," Mr. Gray told media at his shop. "We have picked up just a horrendous amount of product." Before the terrorism-related charges, Mr. Gray was named in another federal case against one of his employees. Special Agent James Coble from the ATF described in an affidavit how the employee and Mr. Gray had allegedly been selling large-caliber belt-fed rifles and other weapons of choice to individuals they know are coordinating the trafficking of these items into Mexico. That criminal complaint alleged that Mr. Gray sold a confidential informant, a Colt 38 super pistol, for $4,000 and grips for $250 that had a rooster design, though someone else, an undercover agent, filled out the federally required paperwork for the sale. The informant told Mr. Gray's employee that the rooster represented the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, which would be the actual recipient, to which the employee allegedly said he understood and continued with the sale. A year after the store opened, in May 2024, an initial federal indictment against Mr. Gray and a co-defendant charged him with several gun-related crimes. Those included allegations of aiding and abetting illegal gun purchases, such as a .50-caliber rifle. The updated indictment in March 2026, a year after the Trump administration's designated the cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, added five new charges against Mr. Gray, including the two terrorism-related ones. The ATF and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Arizona declined interview requests. Those agencies' collaboration on the case stands in stark contrast to their shared scandal in Arizona over a decade ago. Operation Fast and Furious, as it was dubbed, was truly a national embarrassment, says Peter Forselli, a retired ATF official who became a whistleblower. ATF agents, with agreement from federal prosecutors in Arizona, allowed around 2,000 firearms to walk instead of seizing them, in hopes of tracking illegally purchased weapons to cartel-related crimes. Whistleblowing exposed the strategy following the 2010 murder of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry, where guns tied to the operation were found at the scene. Mr. Forselli sees the use of terrorism-related charges now as a positive step. "It is dramatic, perhaps. Yeah, maybe," he says, "but again, the alternative wasn't working." Mr. Gray's business in Sierra Vista is closed. In early May, the shop, which sat next to a nail salon, looked bare inside. Another dealer, West End Pawn and Gun, advertises Mr. Gray's shattered storefront. "Need ammo?" ask the handwritten signs, directing customers four blocks down. Just like everyone else in the American judicial system, he's innocent until proven guilty, says Jim Adams, who manages the pawn shop. "At the same time, we're very cognizant of the need to control the flow of our firearms and ammunition and the currency that supports it going back and forth across the border," says Mr. Adams. "We're very careful here who we do and do not do business with." Several Sierra Vista gun dealers work together to avoid straw purchases, illegally buying a gun intended for someone else, such as a person who's barred from buying them. "Shops warn each other of suspicious buyers," says Craig King, owner of King's Armory. "We will refuse them," says Mr. King. "Then we'll notify the other shops that we had this person in here, and be on the lookout in case they walk through the door, your store too. Firearms experts estimate that a small fraction of licensed gun sellers are linked to gun trafficking. Still, such accusations in a community of licensed dealers looks bad on everyone else, says Sheena Chavez, King's Armory manager. Mr. King supports the use of terrorism-related charges. You keep your nose clean, you don't have that problem, he says. The United States has long debated what terrorism means. While the first Trump administration singled out radical Islamist terrorists in a counterterrorism strategy, the latest such report from May added violent left-wing extremists and narco-terrorists. Typically, terrorism has meant political violence targeting civilians, a label that doesn't make sense to apply to Mexican cartels lacking political goals, says Wadi Saeed, a criminal law professor at the University of Colorado Law School. Those criminal groups are just into self-enrichment, he says. Professor Saeed has criticized the 30-year-old material support law as dangerous and broadening in its scope. The type of charge against Mr. Gray brings the potential of up to 20 years in prison. As president and founder of Global Action on Gun Violence, Jonathan Lowy supports the terrorism-related charges as a legal tool. In his view, the best way to staunch the Iron River isn't by going after individual straw purchasers. Instead, turn off the spigot at the source. Gun dealers, manufacturers, and distributors, he says. Any step by law enforcement to go higher up the food chain is very significant, and that's what this indictment signifies, says Mr. Lowy. If it were done by a Democratic administration, I think you would hear tremendous applause from the gun violence prevention community. Global Action on Gun Violence has represented the Mexican government in U.S.-based litigation. In 2021, Mexico sued gun manufacturers, alleging that their negligence caused gun violence in Mexico. The Supreme Court last year ruled that the lawsuit was barred by U.S. law. Mexico filed a separate ongoing lawsuit in 2022 against Arizona firearms dealers, alleging negligence in allowing straw purchasers to buy guns. The National Shooting Sports Foundation, a firearms industry trade association, says it works closely with ATF to prevent straw purchases. The foundation supports the efforts of the Department of Justice to prevent illegal firearms trafficking to criminal elements within the borders of the United States, as well as criminals and terrorists beyond the U.S. border, spokesperson Mark Olivia said in a statement. The trial involving Mr. Gray is slated to begin August 4th in Phoenix, according to court records. Meanwhile, Customs and Border Protection reports seizing over 900 firearms heading outbound at the southern border so far this fiscal year. Those seizures surpass the totals for fiscal year 2025. Customs officials at Arizona ports continue screening for southbound guns, like the more than dozen rifles and a grenade launcher tube recently found beneath the back seat of a Lexus, driven by an American woman with three kids in the car. Another U.S. citizen's van held seven AK-47s and 11,000 rounds. Public safety matters on both sides of the border, said Mr. Forcelli, the former whistleblower. People living in Mexico are human beings, and they deserve to live in safety. Our next article is Mentoring at This Nigerian Barbershop Gives Boys a Reason to Stay Off the Streets, by Ogar Monday, contributor, Kano, Nigeria. In a narrow room that smells of talcum powder and aftershave, four boys are crowded around a chair. With electric clippers buzzing in one hand, Abdulmajib Bala tends to a customer who sits with his eyes closed in complete trust. Suddenly, the clippers stop. Nothing is wrong. The barber just wants the boys to take in the lesson. "You see what I did there?" Mr. Bala says in Hwasa, the local language, as he tilts the clippers towards the curve behind the customer's ear. The boys inch closer. Mr. Bala adjusts his grip and continues. "Soft hand," he says quietly. "Always soft hands near the skin." Cutting hair is not the point of the mentoring at Abdul Majad Bala's shop in Kano, Nigeria. Instead, the real lessons are structure and a reason to be somewhere. Mr. Bala has plied his trade in Kano's Brigade neighborhood for more than two decades, and many say he's one reason that some boys here have not been swallowed into the life of crime. When a boy first wanders in from the streets lacking direction, Mr. Bala sits him in a chair, gives him a haircut, and talks. Then, when the boy keeps coming back, Mr. Bala puts clippers in his hand and teaches him a skill with which he can build a life. When a boy has a skill, Mr. Bala says, that life of crime is no longer attractive. Kano is Nigeria's second most populous city and a commercial capital for the country's north. It's also a place where many young men grapple with unemployment and substance abuse. The city has one of Nigeria's highest concentrations of Alamirji, boys who've been sent away from home for a Quranic education but often end up in the streets with no supervision. These boys and others like them provide a steady supply for gangs that have long terrorized neighborhoods across Kano. The Yan Daba gangs, for example, trace their origins to the 1950s and 60s when political parties recruited young men as enforcers. The gangs later took root in the streets, offering vulnerable boys money and a sense of belonging. Mr. Bala knows this story from the inside. He grew up in Brigade, and some of the boys he knew joined gangs. "Some are dead," he says. "Others are in prison." Mr. Bala says he was fortunate to discover barbering around 1997 while working as an apprentice at a game store. "I was curious about what I was going to learn each day, and I came back every day," he says. "It kept me away from the wrong crowd." When Mr. Bala opened his shop in 2004, he immediately felt the pull to give something back. He says he began with the son of a neighbor, a boy who was always in bad company. Rather than watch him drift farther, Mr. Bala took the boy under his wing. "I kept him busy," he says, and then began taking in other boys from the neighborhood, teaching them how to cut hair and how to understand what a customer wants. But barbering, he is quick to say, is not the point. "I tell them this shop opens at 7. If you want to learn, be here at 7, he says. That is the first lesson. Everything else comes after. The real lesson is structure, a fixed place to be, someone who notices when you arrive and notices equally when you do not. Mr. Bala says he has trained at least 70 boys ranging from 11 to 18 years old. Some come in on their own. Others are brought by their mothers. Hawa Salisu lives a short walk from Mr. Bala's shop. She brought her son, Kabiru, who was then 13, after he began keeping company with older boys in the evenings. She was clear about what she needed. "All I wanted was someone to help my son," she says, "someone to teach him not to end up on the street." Mr. Bala does not try to do everything himself. From time to time, he brings in respected members of the community to speak to the boys. That includes lawyers, doctors, even former gang members. "One man cannot do it," Mr. Bala says. "A boy needs to see many men who are living right, many examples, not just me." Habib Muhammad Atta came through the shop as a teenager and never left. He now has his own chair inside the shop and is studying banking and finance at Kano State's Polytechnic. But Mr. Bala did not just teach me barbering, he says. He taught me that I am responsible for my life and can make anything I want out of it. Some boys have gone back to the streets. Mr. Bala does not go after them. I leave the door open, he says. They know where I am. Lawal Tukur has been a customer for 6 years and has watched many boys come through the shop. You can see the difference, he says. They're not the same boys you see on the street corners. They carry themselves different. Every new boy starts by observing, sometimes for days, before he is allowed to touch the clippers. Then he's permitted to practice cutting other kids' hair. Mr. Bala corrects with love and praises when it's deserved. Before a boy works on a paying customer's hair, he has already practiced the same cut many times on a mannequin head fixed to a wooden stand near the back wall. The boys are not paid during training, but they are fed, and they receive what Mr. Bala considers more valuable, time, attention, a reason to be somewhere. At the end of each week, the boys sit together for what Mr. Bala calls simply the talk, no agenda. The conversation moves from how to handle a difficult customer and how to save part of every payment to bigger questions about what kind of men the boys want to become. I do not give them all the answers, Mr. Bala says. Some answers they have to find on their own. But I am here to offer them guidance. In the shop on a recent Saturday, one of the younger boys settles into the chair. He sits straight, chin up, trying to look unbothered. An older boy, clippers in hand, still learning, takes his position beside him. Mr. Bala stands back and watches, arms folded. The boy with the clippers glances over, and Mr. Bala nods for him to begin. The clippers start buzzing again. The other boys giggle. Outside, the noise of the city continues, but this boy is learning to keep his hands steady. And here's an editorial from the Monitor's View. Europe shakes off innovation gloom. The continent has deep reserves of talent and technical expertise, as well as shared social values. By easing bureaucracy and promoting competitiveness, the European Union enables more innovation and enterprise to flourish. By the Monitor's editorial board. The handful of U.S. firms that dominate global tech and artificial intelligence has almost universal name recognition. And it's quite widely known that they rely on semiconductors manufactured in East Asia, mainly Taiwan. But it's safe to say that very, very few people realize that the world's only maker of the complex lithography machines used by Asian firms to fabricate the chips that power American tech advances is headquartered in Europe, the Netherlands to be precise. Not knowing this little factoid is about more than industry trivia. It points to long-standing and not entirely merited views of the continent as an economic has-been, held back by red tape, capital constraints, and innovation inertia. In fact, the European Union is making quiet, consistent progress in undoing both limiting perceptions and policies, even as global markets are more focused on multi-trillion-dollar Wall Street listings, SpaceX this week, OpenAI, and Anthropic up soon. Europe is no musty backwater, the Economist stated in April. It has the talent, resources, and incentive to lead. It should start to think and act like it. And it is, especially after growing differences with its longtime trade and defense ally, the United States. These have risen over U.S. tariffs, its talk of taking over Greenland, and its declining support for Ukraine's efforts to combat Russian aggression. In April, the EU updated its regulations to allow large-scale mergers. This past weekend, French mobile carrier SFR moved forward on a $23.5 billion sale to a consortium of telecom operators. A satellite joint venture and a banking merger are in the works, too. The EU is also moving to harmonize regulations so European firms can operate under consistent rules anywhere on the continent. These include online registration within 48 hours for 100 euros, about $115. In the U.S., that process can take a couple of weeks and cost up to $300, depending on the state. Enough gloom, venture capitalist Suranga Chatelchakle declared in the London Times recently. Europe's tech sector, he noted, is worth almost $7 trillion and accounts for 15% of its gross domestic product. Coordinating among 27 member countries, while upholding citizens' values around the environment and social welfare, means the EU doesn't exactly move fast and break things, as in Silicon Valley. But the EU's caution might be an asset that is underrated. Patient capital, deep technical expertise, and regulatory rigor are European strengths, according to Arturo Bris, a finance professor and competitiveness expert. Europe's innovation model prioritizes long-term stability and is particularly strong in areas where technology intersects with social need, such as pharmaceuticals and renewable energy, he wrote in Observer, an online platform. As the continent slowly charts its own path towards both unity and innovation in a rapidly changing world, other countries and competitors might learn a thing or two from Europe. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.